Good morning. On today's programme, China's massive new dam near the Indian border, which is being called a water bomb, and Cameroon's 92-year-old president seeks another term after 4 decades in power. But first we go to Denmark, where a restrictive immigration policy has seen the numbers of those applying for asylum there fall to its lowest point in 40 years. Its hardline approach, spearheaded by the centre-left Social Democrats Party, has been criticised for ignoring human rights and international responsibilities. Currently holding the president of the Council of the European Union, its government is trying to shape a tougher Europe-wide approach to immigration, as Mary Fitzgerald reports.
For more than a decade, Denmark has been an outlier in Europe when it comes to immigration policy. Its approach is anchored in an explicit message of deterrence. This is enabled by the Danes' opt-out clause in the European Union's asylum framework, but critics say it ignores human rights and international responsibilities. As well as implementing restrictive policies at home, Denmark has put ads in media outlets overseas warning would-be migrants of its tough approach. Measured solely by the goal of deterrence, this hardline strategy has been a success. Since 2016, only a few thousand have applied for asylum in Denmark each year. Last year, the number was just over 800, and this year's numbers so far are the lowest in 40 years. Since 2020, more refugees have left the country than arrived, partly due to an increasing number accepting the Danish state's offer of a financial package to return to their home country. Over the past 10 years, Denmark's stance on immigration was often criticised by other European states as too harsh. What has changed more recently is that an increasing number of political parties across Europe point to what they call the Danish model as an example to follow. The twist in the story is that Denmark's immigration policy has been spearheaded by the centre-left Social Democrats Party and not a right-wing government, as is generally the case in Europe. Earlier this year, an article in the New York Times provocatively asked if the left elsewhere should follow the lead of their Danish counterparts if they are to fend off a far right that is gaining ground partly because of anti-immigration sentiment. Denmark is now one of the most vocal voices in Europe, calling for asylum seekers and other migrants turning up without documentation to be processed outside the continent. The Danish government is trying to shape the wider European conversation on immigration while it holds the rotating presidency of the Council of the European Union until the end of this year. The Danes are not only strict when it comes to admitting migrants, but they also insist on robust integration policies. These include a controversial law known as the Ghetto Law, which officials say is aimed at preventing the emergence of what they call parallel societies, dominated by residents with what they classify as a non-Western background. Danish officials like to describe their approach as firm but fair, and they frame it as protecting social cohesion in a country that has one of the highest levels of social trust in Europe. Supporters of these policies include second-generation migrants and more recent arrivals. One of the Social Democrats' key figures on immigration policy is the son of an Ethiopian refugee father. Here in Copenhagen, I met the adult children of Pakistani migrant workers who moved to Denmark in the 1970s, who said the government's policies were necessary. "The world has changed, and migration has changed," one told me. A more recent arrival, an artist from North Africa, told me he agreed with the so-called ghetto law, because he had witnessed how some migrant communities were, as he put it, self-segregating. But critics of the policy say that Danish citizens with a migrant background are often made to feel like outsiders. Those who are skeptical of the Danish model more generally and the idea that it can be applied elsewhere point out that Denmark lacks the colonial history that has long shaped immigration patterns in countries like France and Britain. Its geography also means it is not a frontline destination country like Italy, the closest EU member state to Libya, which remains the main transit hub for migrants who want to go to Europe. Our history, geography, and demographics are unique, so this idea that our experience can be exported is really questionable, one activist opposed to state policies told me. That may be the case, but the fact that the Danish model is increasingly looked to by other European states and the fact the Danes are keen to steer Europe's debate on immigration in a way that fits their thinking, shows something is shifting. For World Report, this is Mary Fitzgerald in Copenhagen.
Next to India, China has been constructing the world's largest hydroelectric dam in Tibetan territory, just 30 kilometres from the border with India, sparking significant concerns in New Delhi. It's feared that this powerful dam will give China control over key rivers which flow through India, and it's being described in some quarters as a water bomb aimed at India. Protests by New Delhi have fallen on deaf ears in Beijing, as Sajida Momin reports from India.
After fighting pitched battles over land, nuclear-armed neighbours and hardened adversaries, China and India are now locked in conflict over water, taking their decades-old hostility and enmity to an altogether new level. The new battle lines were drawn in July with Chinese Premier Li Qiang inaugurating the construction of the world's largest hydropower dam in Tibetan territory, barely 30 kilometres from the border with India. The launch of the massive project on the Yalung Zangpo River, called the Mutuo Hydropower Station, has set off alarm bells in India, even as their disputed Himalayan frontier, known as the line of actual control, is still volatile after 20 Indian soldiers were massacred by the People's Liberation Army at Galwan 5 years ago. Since then, ties are getting frostier and frostier. There are no signs of a diplomatic thaw in the strained relations between the world's two most populous countries. And because of their nuclear arsenals, the whole world has no choice but to monitor the new flashpoints in their ever-deteriorating ties. India, in particular, keeps underlining that its relations with China are far from normal. The mega dam launched last month with great fanfare has angered New Delhi because the Yalung Zangpo River is a transborder river. It flows through the Tibetan Autonomous Region of China to enter India's Arunachal Pradesh, where it is known as the Siang. The Siang flows further downstream into another Indian state, Assam, where it is called the Brahmaputra. New Delhi is livid as the dam now under construction gives China a chokehold over the water flowing south into Arunachal Pradesh and Assam. And given China's past record of belligerence and bullying, there is widespread fear in India that Beijing might exploit its control over the waters to ruin the economy of the country's northeastern states. Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government is particularly worried about India's northeast, as it is vulnerable because it is far away from the mainland and shares borders with not only China, but Bangladesh, Nepal, Bhutan, and Myanmar. The chief ministers of Arunachal Pradesh and Assam have already branded China's new dam a water bomb, which poses an existential threat to both states. According to them, Beijing can potentially turn off the tap at will in the foreseeable future, starving India of water, or suddenly release water to create devastating floods which would destroy land and human life. Some officials have gone on record saying that the dam poses an even greater threat to India's security and sovereignty than China's military might. Moreover, Brahma Chelani, one of India's foremost international affairs expert, has called the Superdam the world's most dangerous project as it is located in the seismically active Sino-Indian border region. This area is prone to earthquakes as it sits on a geological fault line where the Indian plate and the Eurasian plate collide. He has warned that a strong earthquake can simply wipe away millions of people living downstream in India and Bangladesh as well. Ashok Kantha, a former Indian ambassador to China, says that the project, with its very large reservoir in a very difficult area, was very risky, dangerous, and irresponsible. Kantha has advised Prime Minister Modi's government to raise its concern with China forcefully. India's External Affairs Ministry has publicly said that as a lower riparian state entitled to rights to the waters of the river, India is keeping an eye on the new dam. A spokesperson said that the Chinese government has been urged to ensure that the interests of downstream states of the Brahmaputra are not harmed by activities in upstream areas. but the Chinese Foreign Ministry has officially retorted that the project was fully within China's sovereignty. It added that Beijing is sharing hydrological data, flood prevention and disaster reduction information on a regular basis with downstream countries. Some experts believe that the timing of the dam's launch shows that China is weaponizing the Himalayan waters to express its solidarity with Pakistan and exert pressure on India. China and Pakistan are militarily and politically aligned against their common foe, India. In April, India had suddenly pulled out of the Indus Water Treaty with Pakistan after a deadly attack targeting Hindu tourists in Kashmir that New Delhi said was backed by Islamabad. The Indus Water Treaty, mediated by the World Bank in 1960, regulates the division of water from the Indus River and its tributaries between Pakistan and India. While Pakistan is seeking international legal action against India over the suspension of the Indus Treaty, China's move could be designed to pile extra pressure on India at this juncture to help Pakistan. For World Report, I'm Sajida Momin in India.
Finally, we go to Cameroon. The decision by the President, Paul Biya, to stand again for election has raised fears about his age and health. At 92, he's been in power for more than 40 years, prompting many in Cameroon to call for change. Those who oppose his candidacy point to the country's many problems, such as unemployment and underdevelopment, as well as a desire for a younger leadership. Dorcas Ekupe has this report.
As soon as President Paul Biya of the ruling Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, CPDM, announced his candidacy for an 8th term in office, many Cameroonians expressed widespread discontent. The government spokesperson and Minister of Communication, René Emmanuel Sali, has said in an interview with the media organization Radio France Internationale, RFI, that Biya's candidacy was a 50-50 affair, reflecting some uncertainty about the decision. Nevertheless, Africa's second longest-serving president confirmed his intention to run in the upcoming election scheduled for October 12, 2025, emphasizing his determination to serve despite the serious challenges facing the country. This announcement angered many Cameroonians who believe that Biya's long tenure is overdue for an end, especially considering concerns about his health. Barrister Agbobala, president of the Center for Human Rights and Democracy in Africa, conveyed that a younger Cameroonian would govern better than the 92-year-old president. He pointed out that since about 70% of the population is young, Biya at 92 is not the ideal candidate. Given that Biya has led Cameroon for close to 43 years, Barrister Bala suggested that opposition candidates should unite in a coalition to unseat him, as many feel he has overstayed his welcome. Opposition leader Edith Kawala, president of the Cameroon People's Party, CPP, who believes Paul Biya is no longer running the country's affairs because of his age, says those who are the brains behind Biya's candidacy will also control key institutions involved in the electoral processes like Cameroon's electoral body, ELECAM, the Ministry of Interior Affairs and the Constitutional Council before, during and after the election. She stressed that Cameroonians must decide whether to continue the status quo of the last 4 decades or break free from this cycle. Among ordinary Cameroonians, conversations about Biya's candidacy focus heavily on employment, underdevelopment and the desire for younger leadership. Nana Dominique, a law graduate living in Douala, Cameroon's economic capital, explains that he had been doing odd jobs since graduating and hopes a younger generation will be given a chance to lead. Similarly, Francois, a resident of Yaoundé, Cameroon's political capital, believes that someone of Biya's age should be resting. In the conflict-affected northwest and southwest regions, many residents believe that a new president with genuine concern for the country could resolve the ongoing Anglophone crisis, which is a crisis between Anglophone separatists and the Cameroonian government over what those in the English-speaking regions of the Central African country describe as gross marginalization. Meanwhile, citizens in northern Cameroon have criticized the regime for neglecting development in their regions. Abdul Hamadou, a resident in Mara, expressed that Biya has remained in power for too long without delivering meaningful progress. Travelers on the Garangaundere Road, notorious for potholes, also feel neglected by the government. They say with a new leader who will make his collaborators provide the expected results, there will be more socio-economic projects in the nation. Even some of Biya's close aides have turned their backs on him. The withdrawal of two longtime allies of the Biya regime, Issa Chiruma, former Minister of Vocational Training, and Bello Bubo Maigari, former Minister of Tourism, who resigned from their ministerial positions in June 2025, are just some examples. Chiruma declared that it was time for change, stating that a country cannot exist to serve just one man. In a manifesto released shortly after his resignation, he called for the dismantling of the old system in order to move Cameroon beyond abuse, contempt, and the concentration of power. Despite this opposition, President Paul Biya still enjoys support from loyalists. Malomba Esembe, a parliamentarian from the ruling Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, CPDM, publicly declared that Biya remains the only serious candidate for the October 2025 election. Since independence in 1960, Cameroon has had only two presidents, Amadou Ahidjo, who resigned in 1982, and Paul Biya, who has ruled since then. If Biya wins again and completes the eighth mandate, he would be close to 100 years. The president in Cameroon is elected through a direct election by universal suffrage. Candidates run for office and voters cast ballots for their preferred candidate. 13 candidates are running for the October 12 polls. The candidate with the majority of votes wins the presidency. The president of Cameroon holds significant powers. As head of state, they serve as a symbol of national unity and represent the country internationally. The president has executive powers, appoints the prime minister and cabinet members. Cameroonians continue to hope and pray for a peaceful election on October 12, as they believe the happenings and tense atmosphere in Cameroon makes this presidential election the one with the highest stakes. For World Report, I'm Dorcas Ekupe in Cameroon.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or find us on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.